I'm laughing because one of our guests has just arrived. And when I say just arrived, he really has. And that's Mark Caputo, who just took his seat, made it in terrifically fast. And we appreciate that. I got to tell you guys, we've got, what is a barn burner exactly? Whatever it is, we definitely have one going today. And our show is really already started. It started about 30 minutes ago. Unfortunately for you folks out there, you couldn't hear it yet. So I know that this is going to be a good one. Let me quickly introduce my guests. I have CB Hanif from the South Florida Times. He is the managing editor, and welcome and thank you so much for being here.
Good to be here.
And Mark Caputo, who got in by the skin of his pants with the Miami Herald, who's been making the media rounds this week. You were on what last night?
Rachel Maddow's show.
Well, thank you for gracing us with your presence.
Thank
as
you for
well,
gracing
Mark.
Me with being an appearance.
And a fixture in South Florida, Al Sunshine, who has recently left WFOR, CBS4, and welcome, Al. It's always good to see you.
Kelly, great seeing you. Thank you.
Now, before we get into any of our heavy stuff, you got to tell me about what happened. Al gets a phone call from the Dade County Commission. What happened on Tuesday?
Kelly, I'm embarrassed, but basically I was told, hey, Al, you've been a fixture down here. You've been covering news for some four decades. Why don't you come down? We want to honor you. Great. Gee, that sounds great. I get down there. The next thing I know, there's a proclamation for Al Sunshine Day. I get to speak and address the group. Everybody smiles. I get shakes and pats on the back from all of our elected officials. It's really awe-inspiring, and I thank them very much and thank all my fans.
Well, I'm glad to see you get that recognition. I think that's terrific.
Totally co-opted by the politicians.
Well, now they can do it freely. Exactly. I'm Kelly Mitchell. This is the Florida Roundup, and what a week we have had. I can't think of a bigger trial in recent memory that has affected both South Florida, North Florida, Central Florida. It's really been... It's been a separating issue. It's been a galvanizing issue. And let's set the stage for what happened on Saturday night in Sanford.
State of Florida versus George Zimmerman. Verdict, we the jury find George Zimmerman not guilty.
They found him not guilty.
You got to change.
You know, both charges.
You got to change. You got to change.
Why? He killed a young 17-year-old. He didn't have to die like that. He killed them. He should just go to prison for life.
Well, I got Skittles. I got a tea. So everybody better watch out because I'm coming. I got Skittles. I got a tea.
And the news had barely sunk in when we hear from our first anonymous juror, who still is claiming to be anonymous. We know her only as B37, but we also know her from an interview that she gave to CNN, and let's just listen in to what she thought about what happened in Sanford.
There was a holdout, and probably, well, we had another vote, and then everybody voted, put it in a little tin. We had a little tin, fold her a little papers and put it in the vote, and she was the last one to vote. And it took probably another 30 minutes for her to decide that she could not find anything else to hold George on, because you want to find him guilty of something. She wanted to find him guilty of something, but couldn't because of the law, the way the law is written.
All right, CB Hanif, let's get right into it. Was it the law that led to this verdict?
Well, it was the jury's interpretation of the law. They made a decision as a jury, as human beings, and got to give credit to the defense attorneys who essentially made Trayvon Martin the villain in this scenario. As we see, many, many people disagree strongly with the jury's findings.
And were you surprised?
Well, I actually thought that there might be a hung jury. We know from Juror B37 that they went in half voting for conviction. Trayvon's dad on TV last night begged the question, what happened there? And Juror B37 seemed to suggest that they looked at the law and the three who were voting to convict changed their minds.
Now, was it a clean trial? In other words, did the evidence come out as it should have?
Again, open to interpretation. About my sense, and I think that of many of our readers and the folks we're hearing from around the country, and that we're hearing from around the country, is that the jury dealt with a, let's call it a contrived set of facts, a conflicting small group of facts, starting with the fact that the judge did not allow the discussion, any discussion of racial profiling, which, as we now know, many and we've known for a while, many people thought was the obvious issue here.
Mark Caputo, you cover politics for the Miami Herald. You cover a lot of things for the Miami Herald. But was this about stand your ground? Because we heard so much about this law for such a long time, and then suddenly it did not seem to be a part of it, or at least a key centerpiece, as many people thought.
Stand your ground had something to do with the case and the verdict. The case in general, the police didn't arrest George Zimmerman for about 44 days until a new prosecutor was chosen. I think that's one of the main reasons you saw so much media attention. I believe George Zimmerman were initially arrested. Much of the outrage and the attention on Stand Your Ground just wouldn't have been there.
I believe I was hosting perhaps 3 weeks ago before it had just begun. Jury selection was just underway, so maybe 3-4 weeks ago. And the topic came up. What is going to happen, and what's going to happen after the verdict one way or the other? And my sense was fairly similar to what you're saying. The outrage was not about the verdict. The outrage was about no arrest and never having him stand trial.
Well, initially, but continuing on, what has been lost largely in the shuffle, in part because Mark O'Mara, the defense attorney, is such a good attorney, is that Stand Your Ground was in the jury instructions. Juror B37, twice, of her own accord, said, "We looked at Stand Your Ground."
Yes.
It was there, word for word, the Stand Your Ground statute, a portion of it, was in the jury instructions. So Stand Your Ground had a role. The degree to which we know it had a role, we don't know. We weren't in the jury room. Understand that Mark O'Mara was also brilliant in another regard. He successfully argued with Don West to limit the jury instructions so that they didn't have something known as the aggressor statute. If you are considered an initial aggressor, your ability to plead self-defense is greatly diminished. That wasn't in there, and we can go into the complicated reasonings of the law and why it wasn't in there, but nevertheless, they prevailed and the aggressor statute wasn't there. So when B37 said we looked at the law, and she also talked about this holdout juror and how the holdout juror wondered how Zimmerman's initial pursuit fit into the verdict and into manslaughter, she didn't have anything to guide her with the aggressor statute. I'm not saying that if the aggressor language were in there that he would have been convicted, because I think the prosecution did a pretty horrible job, and there weren't really a lot of facts in this case. The only other witness, aside from George Zimmerman, an eyewitness to the actual confrontation, what happened, was dead. He was shot dead. His name is Trayvon Martin. Lastly, Mark O'Mara did a great job in this fashion. He didn't have a Stand Your Ground immunity hearing. By not having a Stand Your Ground immunity hearing, he made it sound as if it wasn't about Stand Your Ground. Well, one of the reasons he didn't have a Stand Your Ground immunity hearing, according to lawyers I've spoken to, prosecutors, is that if you have one, your client might actually have to take the stand. In that hearing, the prosecution can then cross-examine him, and any statements he gives under oath can then be used in his trial. They didn't want that to happen.
Al Sunshine, I went back and forth on this. At some point, I was offended by the thought that everyone felt, well, I shouldn't say everyone, that's too much of a generalization, but so many people were so concerned about what would happen after the verdict. I really wasn't one of them. I'm trying to decide if it is because the Community Relations Board got involved, knowing that there is a history in the Miami area of violence after controversial verdicts. What did you feel was going to happen once the verdict was read?
Kelly, I think that Florida as a state has not learned a lot of the lessons that go back to 30, 40 years ago, the McDuffie days, the Overtown days that we went through. But I think on the positive side, I think that they absolutely have worked much harder than years past to try to get the cooperation of the community with the Community Relations Board, to try to lower the temperature, so to speak, give people the ability of showing their outrage with a little bit of a measured pace, with a little bit more organized structure to it. And I think that with the prayers of the family, basically saying, Trayvon and we would like this to be a peaceful dialogue, I think it went a long way. And I think that one of the lessons that come out of this absolutely is the better cooperation between law enforcement and the community. We've learned our lessons, and I think that you know, this could be a legacy of this case beyond whatever happens with the politics, beyond whatever happens with a lot of the inflammatory feelings that perhaps as a community, we all in South Florida especially have the ability of dealing with these issues, respecting each other's rights, and moving on to see what can be done so it doesn't happen in the future.
If you don't mind, sorry to slightly disagree with a much more esteemed and educated colleague in South Florida, but a big difference...
He's got a proclamation.
This is true. A big difference is that Trayvon Martin was not killed by a police officer. You certainly could make a good argument that Zimmerman was a wannabe cop, but he wasn't a police officer, so that issue was largely removed.
And that gets back to the issue of what the feds may be able to do. But I wanted to go back and echo Al's comment about the family. I don't think we can say enough for the dignity, just for the grace expressed by this family who's lost a child. As the mother said, they put more responsibility on the child than they did the adult. To have experienced what they have and to see how they have conducted themselves has just been awe-inspiring. But at the same time, Trayvon has become a metaphor for the ongoing struggle for social justice. And that's been reflected in our pages, and I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about that going forward. Not just the Trayvon Martin Foundation, but efforts to address voting rights and others.
How sincere do you think this Department of Justice probe, the call for this, how do you see that being handled, and do you think they will step in?
Yeah, I keep hearing that it's a really, really high hurdle, I recognize that it is, but I grabbed something from colorlines.com that indicates some reasons why the feds may be able to do this, beginning with the fact that veteran civil rights attorneys are providing their input. And points such as this fact that because race was essentially exculpated from this trial, the feds may look at it from that perspective.
Now, some of the things that came out in this are this whole notion of these neighborhood watch groups. And we have asked some of our listeners what they've been thinking about that as well. I believe if the reports are true, there was a settlement with the HOA where George Zimmerman lived with the family, Trayvon Martin's family. It's undisclosed. At some point, we've heard something like $1 million. I think that was the highest of the liability that could come anyway. Mark, do you know anything specifically about that?
I don't know anything specifically about this. I would like to go to CB's point about the Justice Department. I think what's been lost in the discussion was last year, the FBI began investigating whether race played a role in Trayvon Martin's shooting by George Zimmerman. And they had concluded at the time, after interviewing more than two, maybe almost three dozen people, that there was no evidence for race. So not only is there a high bar coming into this case objectively for the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice to bring charges, but the FBI, the federal government, the DOJ's own investigative arm, the FBI, initially found no evidence of it. I don't see with all of that how they can bring charges, but again, I don't see all of the facts.
Now, Al, do you see DOJ coming in on this?
I think that absolutely, positively, there will be a much more aggressive investigation. I think absolutely, positively, there will be a lot more questions asked of a lot more people. I think absolutely, positively, those questions will be double and triple checked to see the veracity of them. I think that if the FBI wants to, they can absolutely know George Zimmerman's life history from the moment he was born to the moment of the confrontation. Has that been done already? I don't know. When that initial finding came out that they did not believe it was a racially motivated shooting, how much information did they have? How much double and triple checking had they done? We understand also that there's a website that the Department of Justice may have set up trying to get some information from people in the community to try to develop more information about whether there was any more overt racial profiling by Mr. Zimmerman. I don't know how much of that, you know, will be new, but I think that the American public, whether it's South Dade, North Dade, Detroit, New York, New Jersey, California, I think the American public's will is we want this investigated. If there are civil rights violations, they should be prosecuted. If there are additional charges to be filed, we want it all done in the open. We want the system to be exposed for us to see how it works. The outcome may well be the same. It may well be, because of the way the laws are written, there won't be a solid prosecution with enough evidence to build the case. And it gets to another subject that I think we need to discuss at some point, and that is if the law is turning victims into defendants, if the law favors the aggressor, then what needs to be done to level the playing field and balance those scales of justice?
And while you're gathering your thoughts, let me just give out the phone number quickly, because we will be taking your calls. It's 1-800-743-WLRN. And if you're like me and you hate spelling out phone numbers, that's 1-800-743-9576. Also, our social media editor, Danny Rivero, is doing a live blog as well. And you can go tweet us at WLRN, or you can go to WLRN.org and take part in this live blog with Danny, who's over there typing feverishly. Okay, CB, go ahead.
No, just one quick point on DOJ, and I agree with my colleagues here. The Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Hate Crimes Prevention Act may apply here. So I think the DOJ has a lot that it can look at. We may not hear from them for months and months and months. We may hear from them very shortly. We'll see.
They do move slowly. There's no question about that. Mark?
Yeah, I'm going to say something that is going to get me in trouble with people. I hope they can understand nuance. But the evidence that I've seen so far does not suggest that George Zimmerman was a racist. When he saw Trayvon Martin walking in between buildings around dusk with a hood over his head, yes, it was raining, but nevertheless, in something that disguised his face, not intentionally, but unintentionally disguised his face, in a community that had burglaries, it's understandable that he would have thought, hey, I've never seen this guy before, and he looks suspicious. The other evidence we know, he calls 911. The dispatcher has to ask him, certainly once and maybe almost twice, I must admit I need to review the transcript, what does he look like? Basically, what race he is. Then he says it. He doesn't call up and say, hey, look, there's this weird black guy walking around the community, come help me. So I think that inures to his defense. And then here's probably what's going to get me in trouble. And here's something that I think is not as discussed on some quarters of the news media as it is in others. I'm hearing a lot from a lot of white people, and yes, I'm white, is
really? The,
some of my best believe. Friends are white.
is there is a concern among some, and many of them are white conservatives, that there is not enough discussion of black-on-black crime, the black crime rate, that it is understandable that if he saw someone in his neighborhood, and which the defense said a lot of the burglaries in the neighborhood were committed by black people, that it's also understandable if, in that regard, he found Trayvon Martin suspicious. The statistic that people have noted, certainly conservatives, is that while Trayvon was killed by a white man, a white Hispanic or Hispanic, we can debate what the difference between race and ethnicity is at another time, perhaps, but the FBI's most recent statistics for the nation is that when the race of the victim is white, 3,172 whites killed by 2,630 whites. When the race of the victim is black, 2,695 of them are victims, and their killers, 2,447 of them are black. Blacks kill blacks, more often than whites kill blacks. Whites kill whites more often than blacks kill whites. So there's that. And they're saying, hey, how come we're not hearing more about black-on-black crime, black-on-black violence? So I thought we should throw that out there.
I'm glad it's out there, Mark. And I should preface my comments by mentioning that Mark and I are buddies who go way back. But I'm maybe to bring a bit of levity here, I'm tempted to paraphrase Dan Aykroyd from Weekend Update on the original Saturday Night Live.
Let's see, which one's Jane?
Mark, you ignorant slut.
But I wish I could be a slut still.
No, seriously, I think, well, I don't know where to start. We know that the conservatives' view is not going to be that of Trayvon and his family. The focus on black-on-black crime, to me, is a red herring, and I think our readers would agree. If you look at the columns in our paper this week, strong columns, I know that our writers would strongly disagree. If a guy in Hong Kong kills another guy in Hong Kong, we don't talk about Chinese on Chinese crime. if we're talking about folks who live in a black community, the crime is going to be black on black crime. And so I would like to hear the conservatives investing in education in those communities so that the maybe some of the future George Washington Carvers can stop walking around with their pants hanging down. Having said that, I want to go back to the issue of racism. I think it's easy to say that the facts suggest that Zimmerman was not a racist. Fine. But it also is a fact that Zimmerman was morally culpable from the time this whole incident began and criminally culpable at the end, at least in my view. And I know a lot of people share that view. What we had was a jury that looked at the last few seconds of that whole incident. But Zimmerman was really out of bounds and went off the chain, as young people like to say today. And so we have a youngster who's dead, and the perpetrator acquitted by a jury that did not see race.
All right, let's go to Miami Lakes, and let's go to James, who's been holding for us. James, you're an interesting mix here. You're a former police chief and neighborhood watch. What's your take on this?
Well, actually not a neighborhood watch, but you were correct in saying that I've spent 23 years in law enforcement, 20 years with the Miami-Dade Police Department, retiring as a lieutenant, and served as the chief of police for the city of Opa-locka from 2005 to 2008. I believe all of the points are interesting. Number one, specifically from a neighborhood watch, when we start neighborhood watch programs with citizens in their community, one of the things that that is foremost in our mind that we tell them is, first of all, never to approach anyone, either suspicious vehicles or suspicious persons, because they could be armed and dangerous. And the other thing is that we overemphasize that they are not the police. They do not possess police powers, and we encourage them specifically not to carry any weapons. I want to just tag on to some of the comments with respect to I can't remember one of your host names. But with respect to the black-on-black crime, that is an important issue to raise. I believe it is a different conversation for a different day. The issue that we face today is the killing of Trayvon Martin and basically what it has. It has national and international implications, and I believe it's a litmus test for America. Specifically to where we are in race relations. I want to add that in 1996, I had an opportunity to appear on Nightline with Ted Koppel for a week-long series in America in Black and White. And, you know, one of the important aspects is everybody, when I had on the uniform, could identify me as a law enforcement officer. However, when I was in civilian clothes, there were many times that my former colleagues, some of who did not know who I was, stopped me on the pretext of racial profiling. And during those times, I never identified myself. And then when I did, the question always came, well, why didn't you tell me you were a police officer? Well, if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing and keeping our community safe, the fact that I'm a police officer should have no bearing on the reason that you stopped me. So the issue with whether or not George Zimmerman was a racist, I don't believe he was, but it is my opinion that race greatly influenced his interaction and ultimately the confrontation with Trayvon Martin.
All right, James, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. What do you think about what James is saying, Al?
I think he's got some very good points, and I can tell you through the years I've done a lot of projects with Citizens Crime Watch, and one of the things that they absolutely stress is you are there to observe, you are there to report, you are not there to confront, and I think that most neighborhood watch groups, if not all of them, absolutely prohibit encouraging any of their volunteers to be armed and absolutely prohibit encouraging them to take the law in their own hands.
I think it also points out an interesting thing. There's a difference between racism and prejudice. Prejudice is to prejudge someone. I wonder what would have happened if Trayvon Martin was walking where he was, and I know this sounds absurd, but picture it for a moment, in a suit and tie. Something tells me that he wouldn't have looked as threatening to George Zimmerman. So part of it was the clothing, the attire, which could have fed into that prejudice. But yes, it's a prejudice against blacks and black culture.
And I want to get into some more about this neighborhood watch, but we have a caller, John from Plantation, and right now John's batteries is parting ways with him, so we want to get him on as quickly as possible. John, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to comment on some information that your program has suggested as to do with the FBI civil rights investigations and their conclusions. I'm a retired FBI agent, 25 years, and handled some civil rights investigations, and I'm aware of the procedure. When the FBI receives a civil rights complaint or opens an investigation based on public information, when the case is investigated, the investigative results are submitted to the Department of Justice. The FBI itself makes absolutely no conclusions, suggestions, or recommendations as to the outcome of a civil rights investigation. So previous comments on your program that the FBI concluded that there was no civil rights investigation is incorrect in that, as again, the FBI makes absolutely no conclusion at the culmination of an FBI civil rights investigation.
All right, John, thank you.
That's my only comment.
All right, we appreciate it. Thanks for listening, right, and thanks for calling in. What we're going to do right now is take a quick break because, by golly, we have to. And when we come back, we will consider more of your comments and more of your thoughts and the thoughts of my guests, C.B. Hanif, Mark Caputo, and Al Sunshine. I'm Kelly Mitchell. We'll be right back. We are back. I'm Kelly Mitchell. This is the Florida Roundup. It is our version of the smartest people we know to come in and talk about the issues that have happened this week. There have been quite a few of them. We hope to get to them, but this is such an important conversation. We're going to continue it at least for a little while. And one of the things that a lot of you are calling in on, because this affects you personally, is the neighborhood watch issue. And we will get to some of that as well. But there's some bigger issues that we want to focus on as well. I will say this, though. I'm not going to say where I live for lots of reasons, but I also don't know if my neighborhood watch people might be listening, and I don't really want to offend them, but I do know that there's a car that goes by every once in a while, and I see what I believe are two people in their 80s driving around in this, and I'm wondering if neighborhood watches are going to be in jeopardy because of the liability and because now you don't know whether you should even give people this type of power. A lot of people have told us that they didn't get so much as a pamphlet. They were just signed up and said they do what they want to do. So if you have information on that, what happens with you when you are on Neighborhood Watch, please give us a call because we'd really like to hear from you. That number is 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. You can email us, thefloridaroundup@gmail.com, and also tweet us at WLRN. And you can go to WLRN.org, and our social media editor, Danny Rivero, is a part of a live blog that you can also partake in as well. If you don't know this, if you're not aware of this, something's going on in Tallahassee concerning Stand Your Ground. And there has been a small but healthy group of protesters that are trying to get Governor Rick Scott's attention. Apparently, they were able to get it last night. What they wanted was another look at Stand Your Ground. And basically, they would like to see it abolished, and a lot of people around the country do, unless, of course, I imagine you feel your life is threatened, and then you might think it's a really fine law. What does happen in the future, Al?
Well, I think that one of the most critical things we as a state has to do is look at the balance between fair trial, defendants' rights, and the rights of the victims who cannot speak for themselves. I've covered these kinds of trials for 30 to 40 years down here. We have seen similar results in the McDuffie case. We know that there are ambiguities that defense attorneys are able to wheel and deal and take advantage of if you think that they are. But I think the most critical thing is, where do we move on from here? What do we do with the manslaughter statute? What do we do with Stand Your Ground? What do we do with jury instructions? I mean, I think that there needs to be a fundamental, critical examination of where this state's legal system is, where the residents of this state, the taxpayers, the voters, the mothers and fathers, you know, where do we want this state to be as we get into the 21st, 22nd century? And I think clearly there needs to be a groundswell of political activism in trying to let the politicians know this cannot stand, that there needs to be a public airing, not a witch hunt, not a mob, but there needs to be the ability for various communities and various interest groups to basically say, what can we do to break this continuing cycle and move on?
And CB, I'm sorry, Mark, go ahead.
CB, go.
Yeah, with regard to Stand Your Ground, I think it's really good to see those kids up there. I understand the governor met with them. He confirmed that the legislative review, that panel that he appointed, had gotten his blessing again, which is kind of scary. In the meantime, we have the Trayvon Martin Amendment, and we have folks like Chris Smith of Fort Lauderdale who are emphasizing that you should not be able to pursue and pick a fight with and kill someone and claim to be standing your ground. So I think we're going to be looking at this law. And it's very encouraging to see these young people. I can't say enough for them, not just in Tallahassee right now, but around the country.
And what about this, while we're on this subject, what about this, there's another case, Jordan Davis, and here comes Stand Your Ground all over again.
The difference here, you're talking about Jordan Davis in Jacksonville?
Yes.
A white man who shot black kid at a gas station.
Over loud music, I believe?
Something to that effect. The difference here is that there are witnesses, and I believe he shot a kid in his car. It's difficult to argue that the person you shot was an imminent threat to you for bodily harm, imminent bodily harm, or the fear of death if the person's still in his vehicle and he's not driving it at you. So Davis is going to have a tough time. There's also an interesting case in Port St. Joe, a man named Walt Butler. I saw a little black kid running his neighborhood, started referring to him as the N-word. A black man in the neighborhood who was a friend of Walt Butler's, Walt Butler's white, came to talk to him about it. Like, Walt, what's the deal? This is according to prosecutors. Someone from Walt's house opens the sliding glass door, shoots Everett Gant in the head with a .22, closes the door, finishes making his dinner, calls the police. Police come, arrest him. He says, I don't know what's wrong. I only shot an N-word. He's now pleading Stand Your Ground as well, so you're going to hear more about that.
Even more? I'm sorry, Mark. I'm sorry.
Oh, as for Tallahassee, don't expect anything to change. As CB mentioned, there was a Stand Your Ground task force. Chris Smith, state Senate Democratic leader from Fort Lauderdale, basically says, no pun intended, that it was essentially a whitewash. But nevertheless, the governor says, I'm not going to change Stand Your Ground. I had my Stand Your Ground task force look at it. It's also now become a very partisan issue. When John Holder, pardon me, that's my accountant, when Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, says, hey, we need to look at Stand Your Ground and change it. He's a Democrat. Republicans who control the state legislature say, no way. This is game theory. You, Democrat, choose A. I, Republican, choose B. So if you want it changed, I'm not going to change it. And again, they have the results of their review task force. They essentially recommended no big changes, or they recommended some changes, and the legislature said no way then. They're definitely going to say hell no now.
All right, we're going to take one last comment on Stand Your Ground and the entire Zimmerman-Martin, what captured really the state of Florida. Not everybody. I know there are people who are going to say, it didn't affect me. I don't have an opinion on it, but an awful lot of people do. Javier in Miami, it's all yours.
Hello?
Hello, Javier. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I have a quick comment. A couple years back, my mother, she carries around a gun, and she was attacked, and she had to stand her ground. So I think it should be a right to defend yourself when you're in danger. I mean, but she used it, and those attackers ran away, and it wasn't a problem, and no one got injured.
How old is your mother?
So, how old? Oh, she was, at the time, she must have been 30, 38, 39.
And how big was the attacker?
Well, it was three of them.
Okay.
Downtown.
Just so you know, under pre-stand your ground, if there's a woman who's defending herself against three potential attackers, she still would have been able to use lethal force.
All right, Javier, thank you for your comment. We're glad your mother came through that one all right.
I was going to mention that an even more significant stand your ground case in the news right now is that of Marissa Alexander. This is a woman who was repeatedly abused by her husband, fired a shot in warning, and is now serving 20 years, and we have a strong movement for her to be pardoned.
And what was the reasoning behind that, as near as you know?
Behind what specifically?
For sentencing her to 20 years when there was not even a wound except to the wall.
The use of the gun. To my best understanding, the use of the gun, I think it's inexplicable.
All right, we've covered a lot of ground here, and something in Stand Your Ground or this particular trial pops up, gentlemen, feel free to certainly weigh in again. But we brought in Eleanor J. Brecker, and who I affectionately know better as Ellie. And the other hot-button issue, totally another direction, is the Miami-Dade County budget. And what happened, I guess we're not even supposed to call it the Pets Trust anymore, but a lot of outrage on the part of animal lovers, Ellie, who said they had made their wishes known. They were happy to have their property taxes raised in order to fund a no-kill shelter. And then the whole thing collapsed.
Well, let me clear up something procedural. Pets Trust still lives, and Pets Trust itself has nothing to do with what does or doesn't happen in government. Pets Trust is a grassroots nonprofit, and they had an agenda that they took up when it became clear that for 40 years, animal services in Miami-Dade County had never been properly funded, would never be properly funded. A guy named Mike Rosenberg, who was a proven crusader, took on the Water and Sewer Department, spent 4 years fighting them, got active in Kendall civic affairs and asked to go into the euthanasia room and came out and just was a transformed man. He's the kind of guy who doesn't hear the word no. And he just forged ahead with this. So he started this grassroots effort, and the commission essentially said to him, you go out and prove to us that all of these people want more money for animal services, and we'll go ahead and budget it. So they did. They spent a year, got petitions, held events, got the straw vote on the ballot. It passed overwhelmingly. On Monday, the mayor said, I'm right there with you. We're going to do this. And on Tuesday, he said, no, I don't think so.
Well, he was charged with coming up with a budget. Once the commissioners passed this, he was charged with coming up with a budget. But do you think his heart was ever in it?
That is a question that only he can answer. I can't presume to speak for him, but I do know what he said. And what he said to the Pets Trust people and their supporters over and over and over again is, I'm with you on this. And so did the commission. And, you know, one can only assume that if you hear that over and over and over again, you're going to believe that it's true. And then it wasn't.
Well, some of it seemed to fall apart a little bit when it was initially low-cost spay and neuter clinics, one in the north end of the county, one in the south end of the county. And then something happened with an organization of vets, and it started to seemingly unravel around that time.
Well, here's what happened with that, and it's what has happened every time someone other than veterinarians has tried to get into the mass spay and neuter business. They don't want
that's my turf.
They don't want the competition. And they hired Miguel Diaz de la Portilla to lobby for them. And instantly, the low-cost clinics disappeared from the plan. Now, they started tossing around the term bricks and mortar. There were never any bricks and mortar involved. No one was going to go out and build new clinics. They were either going to get modular, already adapted units to do that kind of high-volume surgery. And I've watched it done, and it's like an assembly line. It's just amazing. It costs $65. The point that Pets Trust was trying to make is that when you pick up an animal on the street, before you can even euthanize it, you've got to keep it for 5 days to see if an owner comes forward. You have to give it shots. You have to feed it. You have to clean up after it. And then you have to kill it. Rosenberg estimates that costs $300. Cost effective? You would think so. But it's like every other mindset about money, not just in this county, but in corporate America, in this culture. It's, don't tell me about the money that I can save 2 or 3 years down the road. Tell me about the next quarter.
Now, the dogs and cats suddenly had their own lobbyist.
The dogs and cats do have their own lobbyist, Ron Book, you know, a heavy hitter, if there ever was one. And he's certainly not throwing in the towel. You know, he's going to fight for more money than what Mayor Jimenez says he's going to find, which is $4 million. $4 million, according to people who really know the dynamics of mass spay-neuter, they said it's pointless. If you're going to do it, you have to do it to where you can get ahead of the problem. $4 million will not get you ahead of the problem.
Now, what will they do from this point forward, or is it just a dead issue?
No, not a dead issue as far as Pets Trust is concerned. They are going to keep on campaigning for what they believe they accomplished in the first place, and they're just simply not going to let up.
And this is all part of the new fiscal year budget that brought up the property taxes. Also, we're looking at layoffs in the county for libraries and for fire rescue. So it was sort of troubling, he said, Mayor Jimenez, that we were back on our financial feet enough to look at raising property taxes, and the masses did not seem to think it was that way at all.
Well, here's where I have a big question about that, and I asked him directly. So you've got 500,000 people who go to the polls last November, whether it was binding, whether it was not binding. You had 500,000 people say, yes, please go ahead and raise my taxes so we can save animals. And he said, well, I could produce that many who don't want their taxes raised. And I said, how? And there was really no answer to that. If there are 500,000 people out there who don't want their taxes raised, where were they on election day on this issue?
And that's Ellie Brecker, who writes about a lot of animal issues for the Miami Herald. I don't think I properly introduced you, but it's only because I know you so well. I figured the folks out there don't know you quite as well as I do. We have just brought in everybody we can find this week because there have been so many big issues. And Christina Vega is here now, and she's been covering a very contentious issue over on Miami Beach, and that is, does Miami Beach become the convention center that it once was decades ago? Where are we on that, Christina?
So on Wednesday, there was a very important vote. The City Commission chose a development team to move forward with the kind of grand vision that has been put forward. That team is South Beach ACE. It's led by Dan Tishman of Tishman Hotel and Realty. Their affiliated companies are doing such projects as One World Trade Center, and also architect Rem Koolhaas, who is a Pritzker Prize winner. He's very well known, and he's the one who designed the winning team's design for a new convention center district.
And this one does or does not yet have residential and retail attached to it?
So there hasn't been a final decision. They'll probably hammer that out today at a commission meeting. But the original proposal was to include housing, and commissioners have been kind of wishy-washy whether they want it or not. So there hasn't been a final decision on that.
And Al Sunshine, you probably know the history of this better than I do, but at one point, I mean, this was political conventions were here. This was one of the places, premier places, for conventions. And then it seemed like there was problems with not enough hotel rooms, and it sort of fell off the
map
because of that.
Kelly, this has been an issue that has been hotly debated by developers and politicians and convention planners and the convention and visitors bureaus probably for 20 or 30 years. We are paying the price as a community today for the inability 20 and 30 years ago to expand, to compete, to develop. And if they finally get off their behinds and finally decide to do something, you know, we're going to see it paying off, you tell me, in another 10, 15, 20 years. But for decades, we've been hearing Miami Beach, one of the premier destinations in the world, doesn't have the facilities, and for political reasons, for all sorts of other behind-the-scenes issues, they weren't ever able to decide. It's the price we've been paying not to be able to attract the major political conventions, the major groups, and all I could say as a longtime reporter and resident, it's about time.
And do you think Art Basel will be placated by this particular plan? Because if you are a longtime listener to WLRN, you know that one of our premier coverage areas is the arts. And that's one of the big driving forces behind this, is we have just gotten established by Art Basel, and they've got a lot of say in what happens here.
I think the hope is that they'll be able to not only retain their kind of banner events like Art Basel, but they'll also be able to attract not necessarily more conventions, but higher quality conventions, medical conventions, and that sort of thing that draw more people from out of town to stay in Miami Beach's hotels and that sort of thing. And I should add that part of the plan does include building an 800-room hotel. According to the design that's been presented, it would go on top of the convention center in this very kind of fantastic way.
Well, it lost us one of the county's finest convention, which is Exotica, which which went up to Fort Lauderdale.
I hear Fort Lauderdale isn't too happy about having it. I'm sure Miami Beach would be happy to have it back. I don't know, though.
South Beach misses the porn stars.
Oh, well, you never know. They might still be there. One of the things that did happen this week, which was rather explosive, if you asked me, and we've kind of ignored our fine friends in Broward and Palm Beach counties today because we did have so many issues, although the Zimmerman-Trayvon Martin situation was all-encompassing. But one of the things that was pretty amazing this week, if you happen to see it, if not, you're going to hear it. Play it, Paul. I just saw Ellie Brecker do her imitation of the Fort Lauderdale, Port Everglades Florida Power and Light facility coming down. The red and white candy cane stacks are no longer with us. I think they were built in the 1960s, and you could truly see the dirty air that used to come out of those smokestacks. So I think a lot of people are pleased. And one of the interesting things I did see coming out of that is that in the two years it will take them to build a plant to replace it, they are going to heat the water, Ellie, you'll like this, for the manatees. So
nice.
They can still hang out there as well.
Good.
I want to thank all my guests for being here today. C.B. Hanif from the South Florida Times, managing editor Christina Vega from the Miami Herald, Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald, Ellie Brecker, Eleanor J. Brecker from the Miami Herald, and Al Sunshine, who gets to go home and do absolutely nothing and not feel the least bit guilty about it. Thanks, everybody, for being here. This is the Florida Roundup for July 19th, 2013. You can listen to our show again at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. I'm telling you right now, I will not be up. I want to thank our producer, Elaine Chan, Alicia Zuckerman. Our intern is Isabel Echarte. I didn't realize I used to be in her father's courtroom. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our social media editor, Danny Rivero. Our producer for WLRN, Peter J. Mertz, technical supervisor Paul Leary. I'm Kelly Mitchell. Have a great weekend.